Well, welcome into the Annie Fry Show. That's about par for the course for today. Jamie Lissau talking about watching the Kamala Harris Bret Baier interview last night and seeing how well that went. Today's YouTube live chat poll, we're asking you the question. We're going to talk a lot about it today on the show, but we want to know what you think as well. Did Bret Baier conduct a fair interview? Yes or no? Lots of people going into yesterday's interview talking about how they just did not trust Bret Baier to do it in a fair way. You were very concerned that this wouldn't be something that was challenging to her. And I think we were able to walk through a lot of what Bret Baier did yesterday. And the question that I asked and posed, and I still think it was important, was, is he going to go quantity or quality on subjects? Is he going to work hard to get credit for asking every single question that is important to every single viewer out there in a matter of a 30-minute interview that was granted to Bret Baier, and to sit down and have that conversation for a mere 30 minutes with Kamala Harris? How would that end up? How would that end up materializing? How would he approach it? Because it's all about the approach. Scheduled to meet at 5 o'clock Eastern, 30 minutes slated on the time. And Bret Baier explained how he really was working to get as much of this done as he possibly could. But having a 6 o'clock show, there's a really quick turnaround in that type of a process.
You know, when the kicker in football, they call a timeout right before he's going to kick the field goal. They're icing the kicker. So we were supposed to start at 5 p.m. This was the time they gave us. Originally, we were going to do 25 or 30 minutes. They came in and said, well, maybe 20. So it was already getting whittled down. And then the vice president showed up about 5:15. We were pushing the envelope to be able to turn it around for the top of the 6 o'clock. So that's how it started. And I could tell when we started talking that she was going to be tough to you know, redirect without me trying to interrupt. I did this with President Obama. At one point, I just said, Mr. President, I know you like the filibuster. I just didn't even have the chance to sometimes redirect in those ways. So I had a lot of other questions.
That's how the interview ended up starting. She was late. She was 17 minutes late for the interview that was limited on time. And then they just said, okay, we'll give you 20 minutes. So you have a 30-minute interview. And I know, to somebody who isn't used to being in that position, that 30 minutes seems like a long time to cover a lot of subjects. I carry out 12-minute, 15-minute interviews with people on the show all the time, and there is a ton of stuff that at the end of that interview, I'm like, I didn't even ask that. What was I thinking? Facepalm. Come on, Annie, be better than that. And then you go back and you look at the things that you did ask, and you're like, gosh, I really didn't want to not ask that instead. It goes, I'm just telling you to take my word for this as a like C-level, as in C as in the grade, not like sea level, interviewer compared to Bret Baier and his expertise. 30 minutes goes by super fast. 20 minutes goes by super, super fast. So Bret Baier had to do what we talked about yesterday and decide, do I go hard in on all of the subjects or do I go hard in on making her prove that she can answer just one single question? That she can show the American people that she has the wherewithal to go through the thinking process, to actually have a discussion with somebody, to try to convince the person that they have a grasp and that they have a plan and that they are willing to do what it takes to make that plan come to fruition. So they show up late, they shorten the length of the interview, and then this is how it wrapped up.
Dana, you've been on the other side. You've been on the wrapper as a press secretary interviewing a president. And, you know, I'm talking like four people waving their hands like it's got to stop. So, Martha, final. Yeah, I had to dismount there at the end. There's so many things, and she maybe should do more of these.
So there you have the explanation of how the thing ended, which is people in the background like they're looking like they're trying to land a plane going, stop, this is a disaster. It's kind of like if they turn around and look at the camera and be like, Leslie Nielsen, nothing to see here, please disperse. That's the way it felt. Kamala Harris was pressed on important issues that matter to the American people. Kamala Harris was put in a position where she had the opportunity to go in deep on some of these topics, and she wasn't capable of doing it. I think that Brett Baier was not only fair, but I think that he should have made a lot of skeptics very proud yesterday to know that journalism still exists in this type of capacity, to understand that we can still push and ask hard questions and refuse to be courted through the interview by the person who is running for office, to be wooed by the potential power that that person might hold. Brett Baier did a very good job in handling this situation, and I think that it should be encouraging to a lot of viewers who were skeptical otherwise. We're going to see if we can listen to and watch a little bit of this first question that was asked of Kamala Harris, and really one of the most important ones facing Americans today about the border.
Jocelyn Nungeri, Rachel Morin, Lakin Riley, they are young women who were brutally assaulted and killed by some of the men who were released at the beginning of the administration, well before a negotiated bipartisan bill. Former President Clinton actually referred to Lakin Riley Sunday, campaigning for you in Georgia, saying if those men had been properly vetted, Lakin Riley probably would not have been killed. So if it wouldn't have happened, this is well before any negotiation. This is well before Donald Trump got involved in the politics. This is a specific policy decision by your administration to release these men into the country. So what I'm saying to you, do you owe those families an apology?
Let me just say, first of all, those are tragic cases. There's no question about that. There is no question about that. And I can't imagine the pain that the families of those victims have experienced for a loss that should not have occurred. So that is true. It is also true that if a border security had actually been passed 9 months ago, it would be 9 months that we would have had more border agents at the border, more support for the folks who are working around the clock trying to hold it all together.
Madam Vice President.
To ensure that no future harm would occur. And this election in 20 days will determine whether we have a president of the United States who actually cares more about fixing a problem, even if it is not to their political advantage in an election, because there was a solution, Brett.
Madam Vice President, it was a policy decision in the early part of your administration. I will let one of the mothers talk about it. Take a listen.
Because of the Biden-Harris administration open border policies, catch and release, they were enrolled in the Alternatives to Detention program. This meant that they were released into the United States. It was not even a full 3 weeks later that they would take my daughter Jocelyn Nungeri's life. I believe the Biden-Harris administration open border policies are responsible for the death of my daughter.
That's the early days. So do you owe them an apology is what I'm saying?
I will tell you that I am so sorry for her loss. I'm so sorry for her loss. Sincerely. But let's talk about what is happening right now with an individual who does not want to participate in solutions. Let's talk about that as well.
But do you want to answer
in all fairness, I told you, I feel awful for what she and her family have experienced.
Kamala Harris did a very good job of making sure that she did acknowledge the hurt that was levied by those individuals who were directly affected by these policies. But at the same time, she also was very dismissive of the idea that her policies are the things that resulted in these actions. She doesn't account for that.
Premise. Jocelyn Nungeri.
So she goes on to talk about how she pushes it on this border deal. She pushes it on the failed border deal that she blames on Donald Trump for somehow or another derailing. Donald Trump is the least influential person in elected office. He wasn't even in elected office at the time. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are shepherding this through. Donald Trump has so much power over the people in the Senate as a person who's sitting out right now, not even in an elective office. He had so much power over these people. He just simply said, don't pass it. And they said, okay. Well, Byron Donalds tweeted out yesterday He said why the Senate border deal failed, and he gives 10 points. Here are 10 reasons why a congressman points out that the border deal failed. Number one, it codified catch and release. Number two, it let in 1.8 million illegals, I'm pretty sure yearly. Number three, it funds sanctuary cities. Number four, it funds NGOs moving illegals. I was in a Catholic Charities when we went down to McAllen, Texas, and I sat in there and we asked questions about how the process goes. And they basically just take people in, wait for an address that is associated with the individual or the child or whatever it might be that's sitting in that Catholic Charities, and they just pass them along. Not some sort of proof of relationship or care or concern. They just need an address. They put them on a bus outside of Catholic Charities and off they go. Number five, provides lawyers to illegal immigrants. Number six, provides work permits to illegal immigrants. Number seven, there is nothing in this bill, in this Senate border deal, there is nothing in it that allows them to deport people who are here illegally. It didn't. Number eight, did not include any immediate wall funds. Number nine, it had very weak asylum screening. And number 10, here's a fun one. In the Senate border deal that Republicans decided, no, we're not going to support, and the thing failed. Number 10 is that it provided $60 billion, billion with a B, to Ukraine. Just slip that one right in there in the bottom. There's 10 reasons from future Representative Byron Donalds' Twitter account that you can go read right now and see 10 reasons why Republicans and conservatives completely outside of the realm of Donald Trump would have said hell no to that bill. And they should have said no. The policies, 94 executive orders of Donald Trump's, were overturned by Joe Biden when he got into office. 94 executive orders, 94 individual actions by the Biden-Harris administration to undo what Donald Trump had done. And we result in these types of numbers. And she wants to just blame it on Trump? Boy, we'll get to more of that as the show goes on, and we are very excited to do so. We need to know, what do you think? Did Bret Baier conduct a fair interview? Yes or no? I think that this is going to be an interesting one to find out how the results shake out. Bret Baier was tasked with the opportunity to challenge Kamala Harris for the first time that she's been truly challenged in her, less than 3 months of running for president of the United States without ever having to earn a vote from anybody in a primary anywhere. You have the opportunity to challenge Kamala Harris, and I'd love to know if you think he did so fairly. Annie Fry YouTube channel to vote. When we come back, we're going to speak with Hans von Spakovsky. Some news coming out on the election front, specifically in Georgia. I keep seeing judges ruling on this, that, and the other thing. Which is it? What is going on in Georgia? We go to the expert when it comes to election integrity. Hans von Spakovsky on the Annie Fry Show next.
In Atlanta.
Today in Georgia, a judge ruled that election officials have to certify results, even if voter fraud is suspected. And around the state, Democrats are suing to prevent drop box surveillance, hand counting ballots, and voter ID protections. Why are Democrats trying to make elections less secure?
Well, you got to think to yourself when those are the types of things that are bubbling up, you're kind of like tilting your head and going, what? Why? It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. Hans von Spakovsky with us right now. Let's talk. Oh, do we lose him? Oh, he's on video. That's right today. He's on video. That's right. Hi, Hans. Good to have you here. We appreciate you coming in. And you are the expert when it comes to election integrity. You wrote the book on it, Our Broken Elections, How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. They don't want us to even be able to look at the drop boxes in Georgia. What is that about?
Well, you know, when you combine all this together, it's like they want to make it easy to cheat.
Yes.
And, you know, this is one of those instances where the leadership of the Democratic Party is totally out of touch, actually, with their constituents. Because, you know, look, like on voter ID, remember, they're still totally opposed to voter ID. Georgia's actually got a very good voter ID law. The latest polling I've showed on this showed that 81% of Americans support voter ID, 69% of Democrats. 69%. That is a overwhelming number. And yet their leadership is out there saying, oh, we shouldn't have to show an ID. And, oh, guarding and surveilling drop boxes? Well, we don't want that to happen. Why in the world would you want anything like that unless you want to make it easy for people who are engaging in fraud to be able to stuff huge numbers of fraudulent absentee ballots in the ballot box? There's no other reason to oppose that.
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre. And for
it is,
for and especially in Georgia. Georgia seems to be one, at least polling wise. Donald Trump has had it's not a huge lead in Georgia, but a steady lead in Georgia, I would say. Right. It's not as close as some of the other swing states are, even though they are all close. What was this ruling that came through? The news alert came through yesterday from Georgia, a Georgia judge talking about the certification of the election results, regardless of allegations of fraud.
Well, it was a bad decision by a bad judge. I can elaborate on that, but I'll tell you, in essence, he said that no matter what election officials see, no matter what evidence they have of massive fraud could occur, obvious, blatant, and yet he says, oh, you got to certify the election anyway. I think that is wrong because as an election official in a county, you swear an oath to uphold all the laws of the state. And that includes, by the way, all the laws that say you can't commit fraud. So I think that was just a bad decision. He also said that an election rule that was passed basically in conformance with state law that said you have to reconcile at the end of the day the number of ballots that were put into the ballot box with, for example, the number of voters who actually registered, you know, when they came in, the number of votes that the computer scanner says it counted before they went in the ballot. You just have to make sure those numbers are the same. Why, you can't do that either.
What?
Which makes no sense.
I was going to say, tell me the part that I'm missing legally, why maybe I don't agree with it, but is there any logic behind taking that off the table to make sure that your numbers match up at the end of the day? Like, what am I not thinking about?
You know, it was interesting. The judge said, this is in accord with the law, but there's not enough time to train election officials between now and the election to be able to do it, and it'll cause chaos. Look, I used to be a county election official in Georgia, and the idea that it would cause chaos or big delays for the two folks who run a poll at the end of the day to simply open up the ballot box, count, are there 1,000 ballots in there? And then check the number on the computer scanner. Does it show that it counted 1,000 ballots? That's not difficult. That's not going to cause chaos. It's easy. And listen, if the computer scanner says, well, I counted 1,000 votes, but when you count them in the ballot box, there are 1,050. That means the scanner is messed up and didn't count all of the ballots. Obviously, you would want to know that. And yet this judge says, oh, no. But this is, I don't, and if you know about it, this is a bad judge. A year ago, he suddenly declared Georgia's abortion law, which has been in place since 2019. He said it was unconstitutional. The Georgia Supreme Court almost unanimously overturned his decision, said he was wrong. So what does he do? A month ago, he issues a decision saying it's unconstitutional again, defying the state Supreme Court, and they just issued a stay of his ruling. That's the kind of judge you have assigned to this case.
It's bizarre to observe from the outside looking in as someone who's by no means an expert on the legal system, which is why we have experts like you, Hans von Spakovsky, on with us, who is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, as well as a former FEC commissioner. You hear about these rulings like this and everybody seizes up on whatever the ruling is, super good or super bad, for whatever their side is on whatever the issue is. And then there's always an appeal and then everybody has to sit and wait again. So it's a lot of hurry up and wait. Is this election, or is this judge's ruling final for this election, or will we see an appeal 70 times before the actual election gets here in 19 days?
Well, It's probably too late to get a change. I mean, the only thing that could possibly happen is if they file an immediate appeal of this decision and the appeals court or the Georgia State Supreme Court issues a stay saying, no, his order won't go into effect while this is on appeal. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I suspect it probably won't get done because we're less than 3 weeks.
Yeah.
From Election Day and early votings are, you know, starting in the state. And so I suspect the upper courts, the appeals, the Supreme Court are going to say, well, we just don't want to get into this right now.
Ugh, man, we're speaking with Hans von Spakovsky with the Heritage Foundation. You talked a little bit about the ruling about the certification of the results, even if there's an allegation of fraud. And I want to ask you, since you are the expert when it comes to these things, to explain to us in simple terms the certification process, because these are things that we've been hearing about for years now.
Right.
Questions about certifications. There's, slates of electors. There's all of these things that we only talk about when election season comes around, unless you're nerds like maybe we are here on the Andy Fry Show. Explain the process to me and what this ruling does to that process.
Well, you know, what happens on Election Day, as you know, is, of course, the votes have been cast and finally get counted. They get tabulated. And oftentimes in some states, the day after the election, they do what they call a canvass, where they go over the numbers again from each polling place to make sure that there were no mistakes and no errors. And then what happens is whoever the chief election official or the county board of elections for each county, they have to have a meeting. And at that meeting, they decide, okay, the results of the counting of ballots, is it final? Has everything been resolved? Can we now declare these are the official results of the election in our county? That's what certification is. It's the local election officials declaring these are the official results of the election, and here's our signature in which we all certify. This is the official count and official end of the election in our county. That's what certification is.
And so if there are people in that meeting and they're saying, oh, no, we have numbers that don't match up, or I don't know, pipes bursting in the middle of the night, whatever it might be, if those allegations are there, even if they're very obvious, evidentiary, provable, what did the judge say about the requirement to certify those results?
He says you can't do anything about it. You, the election official, can't do anything about it. He says all you can do is make a note for the record so that if a lawsuit is filed after certification, why, that's up to the courts to determine. You, the election official, you can't do anything about it. You have to certify it, which, like I said, as a former county election official in Atlanta, in Fulton County, makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, we're just laying the groundwork here. It seems like, I don't want to know how the movie ends and not like the ending that we can see coming and know that we can't do anything about it. The last question I have for you, Hans, and I think that this is one that is weighing on a lot of people's minds as we get very close, 19 days from Election Day, which gives us election night. What states do you expect us to not have results from at the conclusion, 10 p.m., 11 p.m., I'm talking Central Time, midnight, on election night?
Well, Pennsylvania goes to the top of my list because of the fact that, they've changed the law there to allow absentee ballots to come in after Election Day. So I really don't know how long it's going to take them there to get the results in. I would also be worried about North Carolina simply because of the hurricane damage there, which the counties affected are about one fifth of the vote in the state.
It's a lot.
And that's a lot of votes. So hopefully they are going to be able to get the votes counted. Hopefully people will be able to vote, get the votes counted and get it in on time. But I just don't know if that's going to be a problem. Georgia had about 55 counties affected by the hurricane. And I don't know if that's going to delay the election. And look, Florida, Florida has greatly improved its election since 2020. I mean, they've become one of the top states in the country. But man, they had a lot of hurricane damage too. So again, I don't know how much that's going to delay the results out there. And Arizona, well, Arizona has been the subject of huge fights. And we had a very close election last time. So again, I don't know how quickly we're going to get an answer there.
Do you feel like Arizona is in a better position for the 2024 election than the 2020?
Slightly better. They've been so embarrassed, I think, by some of the problems they had, including, as you know, one of the last elections where the machines they were using for printing ballots quit working on election day and they couldn't print out ballots. And I'm hoping that the election runs smoother. The problem there is that in 2023, a Democrat replaced the prior Republican Secretary of State. And it's not that I have anything against Democrats, but this particular Secretary of State, any measures to improve the integrity of the election process, he's against.
That's frustrating. So you're saying, I heard you say Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida all have reasons to believe that maybe there won't be an election night result to report.
Right.
In any of those cases, in any of those states, is it possible, I mean, knock on wood, that it would go the way I would want it to go, that the margin of victory at the time at 10 p.m., 11 p.m., midnight Eastern, that the margin of victory is such that they can go ahead and report it?
Yeah, no, I think that could very well happen. But again, that look, you know what the polling shows. We had a very close election. I saw this morning that Trump is now 2 points ahead in the national polls. But, you know, national polls don't really tell you what's going on in each state. And that's an issue. Plus, voting started in places like Virginia at the end of September. So a lot of people have already voted. So it's very possible we could quickly get a result, but that's going to depend on the margin of victory of whoever is ahead.
All right. Well, Hans von Spakovsky, thank you so much for lending your former FEC commissioner expertise to us here. And I encourage people to check out your book, Our Broken Elections, How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. It's a must read, especially for people who want to understand these things better. Hans, we're grateful for you. Thanks for being here again today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yep. As of course, happy to have you. Hans von Spakovsky there, always a great interview. Make sure you check out the Annie Fry Show podcast if you want to hear the whole conversation. If you didn't get to hear it, we'll have that up shortly here on the Annie Fry Show podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. It's up there. Go check it out. When we come back, Wiggins America in studio with us right here. And you can go vote in that YouTube live chat poll if you want to join us on there. That's the first time we've had Hans on the video with us. That was wonderful. I knew that was happening, and then I went to look at the phone, and he wasn't there, and I thought we lost him, and he was looking at me. That was interesting. On the YouTube live chat poll, did Brett Baier conduct a fair interview, yes or no? Got to let us know what you think on the Annie Fry YouTube channel and our live broadcast there. Wiggins America, next. Don't go away.
Ransom got rotten, a piece of my childhood will never be forgotten.
Wiggins!
We interrupted Linky Boom Boom Down, whatever that was.
Sounds like a Ryan Shire Wigglesworth reading waiting to happen.
Just the lyrics of that song?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not opposed to that. Let's talk about what the young people, what this younger generation is doing in America right now. There's a few trends that I'm going to run by you, see what you think about them. The first is, thank you, Ethan, for joining us and representing Gen Z.
You're welcome.
The first one is that Gen Z is confused why older generations, like us apparently, but even older than us, are using boomer ellipses. They say it's insane
Linky
at
boom
best.
Boom.
Linky boom boom down. They say when typing a
that
large
sounds like
paragraph,
a commercial you'd hear on a station like this. Are you a boomer and feeling leaky?
Well, try our leaky boom boom down.
Or do you want the leaky boom boom up?
Check out beta prostate.
Jeez.
We just lost half our audience. Yeah. Just the men, though. The women thought it was hilarious.
They're loving it. Hey, welcome back, ladies.
Yeah.
So when typing a large paragraph, older adults might use what has been dubbed boomer ellipses, multiple dots in a row, also called suspension points.
Are they just three dots, which is what you call an ellipsis?
That is correct.
Not boomer ellipses. They're just ellipses.
Or suspension points. To separate ideas, unintentionally making messages more ominous or anxiety-inducing and irritating.
This is what we...
To Gen Z.
No. Gen Z is anxious and irritated. That's just the way it is. Yes?
We are. Ethan? I don't know. Yeah. Am I Gen Z? Is that what I am? Yeah, we've had this conversation before. I don't know what I am. I always forget.
What about ellipses? Do you use ellipses in text messages?
No.
You don't?
I know someone at this station that does to me, though.
I think I do sometimes, but I don't do it often.
Well, I wasn't referring to you.
Okay, good.
Was it me?
No.
No, okay.
No one in this room.
Somebody at the station.
You can't use an ellipsis when it should be a period or an exclamation point or question mark. Like, you can't ask a question like... Are you going to get that sound? Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, it's like...
That's like, hey, jerk. But if you say, are you going to get that sound? Question mark. It's a question that needs to be answered. But the dot, dot, dot is the little extra sass.
Well, here's where it comes in, right? For Gen Z, it is that, what are you trying to insinuate? And for boomers, it's not. So there's just a miscommunication somewhere.
I don't know if I'd underestimate the boomers. What year were you born?
2000.
1997 to 2012 is Gen Z.
So I'm Gen Z.
I'm a Z-er.
You're a Gen Z-er the way we are millennials, because millennials is 1981 to 1996.
And I'm 1981.
And I'm 84, and you're 83.
83.
Yeah, so
I'm right on the border.
Outskirts.
Yeah, I'm borderline Gen X, but...
Just so everybody understands, though, the youngest millennials are 28 right now, so... If you want to crap on young people, you give it to Ethan's generation.
Yeah.
Give it to me.
Or Gen Alpha.
Dot, dot, dot.
You can go even younger now with the next gen with Gen Alpha,
yeah.
too.
We've got 401Ks.
The oldest Gen Alpha is 11. Leave them alone.
I don't care. Go after them.
Who named them? Like, we're going to be the alphas.
The internet.
Millennials were supposed to be Generation Y. Mm-hmm. They are Generation Y. But we also came of age over the millennium. Which was a big deal.
I like that boomers
that turned out to be nothing.
And millennials have a name. Gen X, Z, Alpha. I don't love that. The example that...
Okay. Dot, dot, dot.
Dot, dot.
The example they gave is one that you kind of gave. When somebody should use a period or an exclamation point, and instead they use dot, dot, dot.
What about when you start
like, thanks,
a sentence with
dot,
like,
dot, dot.
So... So are you gonna?
So, dot dot dot.
Yeah. Whoa. Ethan's starting to break out a rash and twitch a little.
Actually,
bit.
The more
there.
We talk about this, the more I kind of agree with Gen Z.
Yeah.
You got to use it right though.
Doesn't it?
You're one of us.
Doesn't it completely matter who's sending it?
Yes. Yes.
100%.
Yeah.
I mean,
it does. 100%.
That's like anything.
Right. All right, next trend from Gen Z. They are feeling guilty about taking lunch breaks and even skipping meals at work.
Good. Welcome to our experience growing up.
Yeah. That's well, our current experience
actually,
makes lunch difficult.
Elder millennials, we take on the like work ethic of the older generations that are out there, and then that kind of tapered off throughout the millennial generation.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like young people are at least mindful of, I'm here to do a job.
It says 47% of Gen Zers miss out on lunch twice or more per week, skipping lunch to just get more work done. I guess I'm a little surprised by that.
I am too.
We have a very interesting relationship with lunch.
We don't. Here on we don't have lunch.
or you kind of...
Did you get a mouse in your pocket?
Wedge it in somehow. And like, I run and try to get something. Otherwise, you're just doomed until 3 o'clock. Brad eats lunch at 3:05.
3:05.
Yeah.
I don't eat lunch.
His lunchbox with his barbecue chicken and his yogurt. And then Wiggins usually is gone between... The
11,
period of
11, 11
and 11, yeah.
Yep.
And usually I know that he's downstairs at KFC.
Every once in a while I'm pulling into the station and I see Ryan Wiggins walking just like Will Ferrell and Elf through St. Louis, just very happy.
Yeah, getting hit by cabs.
He's on his way to go into food.
Yep, just looking for food.
Not a concern about a thing around
that,
him.
No, that gum swinging under... his arms with
Hi,
a really
buddy.
Broad
yeah.
step.
What's your name?
And he's just happy.
You got to have enthusiasm because we're in the middle of a food desert. And you really got to search.
You literally had KFC for... a year.
Okay, fine.
And it's in our building.
KFC is downstairs.
Yeah, Papa John's, which so you eat regularly.
Is still Smoothie King?
And Schnucks is right down the street for their food.
I want to thank you, Ethan, for bringing up my point. All the rest of the restaurants have abandoned us.
And they've abandoned downtown. And that's abandoned a different downtown. Segment.
The new Gen Z status symbol is, of all things, super expensive snacks. Increasingly, young people are hankering for pricey foods. In a McKinsey survey in February, groceries represented the top category.
Is there a better indication that inflation has ruined everything? That instead of getting an expensive handbag, you're like, look how expensive my snacks are.
Yeah. No expensive cars.
What is an expensive snack?
That's what I'm waiting to hear.
Gen Z and millennial respondents said they plan to splurge on snacks, outpacing restaurants, travel, and fitness. To be sure... Gen Z is doing this. That's a problem.
Yeah.
They said that they're doing this as a status symbol because it's so hard to afford other status symbols.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That they are buying things like...
Hope you're voting for Trump.
Have you heard of Poppy? I don't know what this is. It's a beverage.
Like the opioid?
P-A-P-I?
P-O-P-P-I. And Olipop?
Oh, is that like a kombucha?
Maybe. I don't know.
Sparkling something?
The only one I recognized in here that gets put into this category is Liquid Death.
No.
Liquid Death is water, if you're not familiar with it. It is just a can of water, but it looks like it's a tattoo on the outside, and it's called Liquid Death. And you pay more for it.
And it's what gives you life.
It's quite opposite the name. But people, Gen Z especially, is grabbing onto these things.
Tiffany says it's a probiotic soda, which I am. That's why I thought it was like a kombucha.
Ah, okay.
You're getting to that age apple where cider it helps vinegar. You go. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yes. Apple cider vinegar?
Yeah.
You ever had that stuff?
Yeah, tadpole water. Have you had that? You know what that
put
is?
Yeah, I do chest. Know what tadpole water is, actually.
In the trendy sense or in the water that tadpoles swim in sense?
Oh, the tadpole water, the stuff that tadpoles are in.
That was incredibly convincing. Thank you. Go on. I believe you.
The first option thing you said.
This is where the old people come to hear the cool things.
This is where frogs come from.
Well, when two frogs love each other.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's actually,
that mother
it's
and
not,
father do.
It's not a beautiful thing. No. It's not a beautiful thing.
It's listen, an icky boom boom.
They're
two frogs love each
it's
other
an
very
icky
much.
Boom, boom.
As Annie said, they get in the water and then you don't know
don't
what
you
happens.
You always take it too far. We dance around the subject, and the people who want to know understand, but you make it clear for everybody in the car with mom right now. Yeah. Knock it off.
You're talking about amphibian intercourse. All right, last one. The name of this hour now,
yep.
By the way.
No, yep. It's not. Amphibian. Not the hour. You don't get the hour. You get one segment.
Hour one, amphibian intercourse.
The hour, if hour one is amphibian intercourse, uh-huh. Which we've now said four times in this segment, I am going to Steve. If you do that, if you name the hour that, when we had a very intellectual conversation with one man whose name is Hans von Spakovsky, and you lump that under that category.
Anyway,
no, Steve, we need to talk.
My point is,
no,
that's how tadpoles are made.
In the water. Which you drink for health.
Yep, you
benefits.
Drink that tadpole water. Right after all that nasty stuff's happened in it. Yuck. Anyway, last one.
Get it together, man.
No, there are
come
times,
on.
There are times that you're like, I'm on the radio right now. This is one of them. Nearly half of young Americans are relying on the bank of mom and dad to get by. And parents...
this just in. This generation.
are having to figure out
Ethan
when
says,
to turn off the tap. The study found that 46% of adult Gen Zers rely on financial help from their parents, ranging from covering everyday expenses to helping with significant financial commitments such as rent, mortgage payments, and other debt repayments. The big question is, and I don't think any of us can answer this question, but this is more posed to you if you're listening, when do you turn that off? It's got to be different for everybody.
It's absolutely based on it's a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, what is your kid contributing? If they're in med school and they're working their tail off to be a doctor or something like that, and you're helping them out along the way, that's one thing. If you're just facilitating a lifestyle of laziness, then
and debauchery,
maybe, or just Laziness.
Ethan.
Ethan's got a job, which he does very well, I might add.
Oh, how kind.
Dakota Wood when we come back.